The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
Reading Paul Theroux's new book, Ghost Train to the Eastern Star, on the tracks of the Great Railway Bazaar, may, as Pico Iyer claims, make you want to jump on the next plane to Istanbul or take the night train to Jodhpur, India, where the women on the train platform, as Paul Theroux writes, are dressed in yellow and red saris, russet shawls fringed with gold embroidery, or long saffron wraps, winking veils, heavy gold jewelry, ropes of knuckle-sized beads and heavy bangles, feet and hands painted with henna, the age-old plumage, brilliant and colorful. That's the magic of Paul Theroux's writing. Theroux, who practically invented the art of travel writing, is the author of many books and the recipient of many prizes, including the Whitbread Prize for his novel Picture Palace and the James Tate Black Award for The Mosquito Coast. With the publication of The Great Railway Bazaar by train through Asia and continuing with the old Patagonian Express, he established himself as America's foremost travel writer. His most recent work of fiction is the novel Blinding Light, and we are delighted to host him here tonight in counterpoint to the debates. Tom Kerwin is a staff writer and editor at the Los Angeles Times. You probably read Tom's long piece on candidate Barack Obama in the Times after the nomination, or his prize-winning feature on hikers who survived a grizzly bear attack. He was the editor of the late lamented Outdoors section. He's been a writer for the Features section and a deputy editor of the Book Review. Among his many awards, he's been honored by the American Association of Sunday and Features Editors for three pieces he did for Outdoors on caving with nature writer Barbara Hurd, on Alaskan bush pilots, and the annual migration of sandhill cranes to the Bosque del Apache. Please welcome Tom Kerwin and Paul Theroux. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. How nice to join all of you here this evening. Did you all survive the debate?
Yeah.
Who won? No. Let's not get started on that. Please. We're here to discuss somewhat loftier matters, perhaps.
No.
I'll put that up there in case we lose track.
Yes.
I'll put that book.
Yes. Not loftier. Different.
Different matters.
Good debate, I thought.
But different matters. Paul Theroux, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine, yes.
It's a great honor to be on the stage with you. I think I think many people in the audience have read at least one or two or three of, as we were just saying, 42 some odd books.
Yes.
It's quite extraordinary. It's quite extraordinary. Yeah. And Ghost Train is an extraordinary chronicle. A really interesting look into who you are, I think, in a way that all your books provide, but this one in particular, because, of course, you retraced a trip that you took when you were in your 30s, and this was in the early 1970s or so. In the course of the book, he writes a lot about, and he has a line or two about the literature of revisitation. I love that line, and he dips into, in a way that I would expect him to, Wordsworth, and he has a quote here and there from Tintern Abbey, which is also a great book about the literature of revisitation. And I think that's what makes Ghost Train such an interesting sort of chronicle of a trip and of travels and of his life, in a way. And I guess that's where, you know, we'll talk about the countries and the adventures in a second or two, but I guess I'd like to open up the conversation today to talk a little bit about you. As I was thinking about this, and maybe to put a grand point upon it, I often think of travel as a journey into the soul, as we confront our own desires, our impatiences, our biases, our frustrations, and our interactions with a foreign people, foreign countries, foreign cultures. And so I guess what I'm wondering is that after some 30 years or 30 years later, I'm wondering, how has your soul changed in the course of that, in the course of those 30 years?
My immortal soul is something I used to think about when I was when I was an altar boy. I don't know how my soul has changed, but my inner being has changed. First, the literature of revisitation, as you said, is Wordsworth is an obvious person, but a person I think of is Richard Henry Dana, whose soul was in pretty good shape. Richard Henry Dana wrote 2 years before the mast. Many of you have read this book, am I right? It's sometimes seen to be a kiddie's book. Actually, it's not. It's a serious book about a voyage taken by a guy in 1836 who came before the mast, which means in the bow of the ship, climbing the masts and putting up the sails, and he came or sailed down the coast through the Atlantic, through Brazil, past Brazil, around the Horn, up the west coast of South America to San Francisco, stopping on the way. And he stopped in Santa Barbara, for example, and he stopped in San Francisco. 24 years later, he took the same trip. He was wealthier. He was a lawyer at that point, and he remarked on the changes. Mm. There aren't many people who take the same trip again. Graham Greene went to West Africa and Mexico. Bruce Chatwin went to Patagonia. Lots of people travel and they write a book as though it's the last word. When you get older, when you get to be my age, when you look at me, you got to think I'm Dick Cheney. I'm Dick Cheney's age. Dick Cheney wasn't in the Peace Corps.
We should be so lucky.
Dick Cheney got 4 deferments and so never went to the army. He's sending your children into harm's way, but he didn't go into harm's way himself. He was in Washington with Greece, you know, just greasing him and finding his way into politics. Knew nothing about the world. Bush knew nothing about the world. It's interesting, though, that Obama knew quite a lot about Indonesia, and his version of the Peace Corps was to work on the south side of Chicago among disadvantaged people. A noble thing to do, I think. So, just to return to this revisitation.
So easy to
Dana
digress.
Dana went around. No, I think I began life as a traveler. And I think that in terms of the soul, I don't know. In terms of widening your understanding of the world, the more you travel, the farther you go from Wasilla, the more likely you are to understand... And if you haven't gone very far from Wasilla, you really don't know much about the world. So In spite of those
views of Russia.
I joined the Peace Corps in 63, and from very late in 63 to 65 was in Central Africa, Malawi, and then in Uganda. And I went back there as Dana went back to San Francisco 24 years after 2 years before the mast. His 2 years on the ship, about 30 years after I first went to Africa, I went back to Africa, wrote a book about it, Dark Star Safari, and it was such a revelation that revisiting Malawi after all that time, I began to understand this: what happens, what time does. I mentioned when you get to be my age, which is, that's how I got on this diversion of I'm Dick Cheney's age. So I, class of 59, I'm Ryan O'Neill's age, you know. Martha Stewart. Jesse Jackson is my age. Bob Dylan is roughly my age. So we're all class of 59, roughly. But since I graduated from high school in 1959, the world has changed a lot. In the 1950s, the population of the United States was 150 million. Now it's 300 million. So there's twice as many people, maybe 5 times as many cars. And so as you grow older, there's a roundabout answer to your question, but as you grow older, you really do begin to understand what time does to people, what time does to places, what the effects of greed, the effects of money, the effects of population, the effects of pollution, the effects of the loss of hope, or hope for that matter, how a place can be transformed, either made much worse or much better. The bright spot, of course, is Vietnam. We dropped 7 million tons of bombs on Vietnam. We dropped 20 million gallons of defoliant on Vietnam. Do the Vietnamese say, the hell with you, damn you, never forget, it was your fault? No, they don't. We're welcomed. The lesson of this book, in terms of my soul or understanding, was that forgiveness, whether it's Buddhist forgiveness or just the normal human wish to make something better, but to forgive is a wonderful thing. It makes you better. It makes you able to solve problems, to look ahead. If you're consumed by bitterness about the past, you really don't succeed very well if you're simply looking at the past. So I think that my understanding has deepened through travel and by revisiting, mm-hmm. I've understood much more.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. What you just said made me think of this. A lot of writers that I talk to in the course of their careers often can't reread their early books. They view them as being sort of immature and of a certain time and era that they've grown well beyond, and they kind of wince a little bit when you bring them up. So I wonder if in the course of writing this book and thinking about your current journeys, did it make The Great Railway Bazaar a little... Did it cast a shadow upon that book or what that book was? Or does that book still stand up as strong and as vital in your mind now that you've done this revisitation?
That's a really good question. If you ask ask a writer about his or her earlier books, it's a really tough question because each of the books that I've written, 40-odd books, I wrote a particular time in my life. And when I think of books that I've written, when I look at the text of the book, I don't really see the book. What I see is where I was living, how much money I owed, desolation of not finishing it. I remember I was writing The Mosquito Coast, and a year after I started, I put dates on the page, and I thought, last year at this time, I had put the date on the page, whatever the date was. I was doing exactly the same thing that I'm doing now, just going up to my study, working. A year ago, I was doing, and so I had a one-year anniversary of writing The Mosquito Coast, and I thought, this is terrible. When am I going to finish this thing? So when I read The Mosquito Coast, I see it. I still think it's a good book. It's a worthy book. It's a book really written about a time very similar to the time that we're living through now, which is energy crisis. I started in the late 1970s. It came out in 71 and published here in 72. But it was written at a time of crisis when people were saying, what's wrong with this country? If you remember the gas crisis of 77, 78, people were saying, what's wrong? Why do we owe money to the Middle East? Why are we beholden to these people who don't understand us? Why are we... there were lines at gas stations. Do you remember them in the late 70s? And people were saying, maybe this isn't such a great country. Maybe we should leave. Maybe there are better places. Go. And so I thought, fiction is about what if. So when I had a character take his family and go to Honduras and just set up his version of a kind of utopia. Mosquito Coast, I think, is a very timely book now. If you haven't read it, have a look at it. You'll see that the things that Ali Fox says in it resonate now. But when I think about that book, The Great Railway Bazaar, I don't really think about... I'm not looking at the text. I'm thinking of worries. I mean, when I came back from the Great Railway Bazaar trip, my family life was in ruins, and yeah. My wife had taken up with another guy. My kids were very confused. I'd spent all my money, and I thought, I have to make this trip pay. So I think I just see worry, 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 and the reviews were pretty good, but I don't see the text. I don't see the text. I'm a very bad rereader of my books, and I think most writers cannot be their own readers. If I wish I could be reading my book as though for the first time. I can't. I spent too much time on it so that I can't read it in the way that you read a book of mine. You might have a completely different impression of a book of mine from what I have because I think of the circumstances of it and all the things I left out or had hoped to do and all the false starts, and you just see a finished thing that you could start one day, read it, for a couple of days later, close it, and say, yeah, pretty good. But it's taken me 2 years to do that, And I'm not a good rereader. But as I say, I just see the circumstances, debt, and worry. And worry, well, not now.
It's interesting, you know. Ghost Train is pretty confessional in a way that the Great Railway Bazaar was not confessional. In that first book, you didn't reveal nearly as much of your sort of internal drama and uncertainty. And in Ghost Train, you have a line where you talk about the Tao of travel, and you write that if one is loved and feels free and has gotten to know the world somewhat, travel is simpler and happier.
Mm, that's true. I think that travelers come from great countries. This is a great country. This is a country you can set off from, and you know you can come back. There are places where people set off from, and they don't know where they're going. They're fleeing a country. They're trying to get away. The great travelers, I think, don't come from small, incomplete, dysfunctional societies. There may be some, of course, but I think the great travelers have a home to go back to. They're whole, complete people who are going out not to find a new place in the world, but to go and discover with a lot of confidence and a certain amount of happiness. The other thing about writing about marital discord and so forth when you're 30 years old is it wasn't until I was in my 40s that I began to understand how to write about my life. I didn't know how to write about myself. I didn't know how to write about what was going on in my life, my marriage. I was living in England at the time because I'd lived there for about 15 years. And I simply didn't know how to go about it. I didn't have the perspective. It's later on, Auden said, if you write about your life, it's like spending your capital. You're just using up your material. It wasn't so much that as I just didn't know how to do it. So when I wrote The Great Railway Bazaar, although terrible things were happening in my life, it's a pretty jolly book. And I thought, it has to be a jolly book because I can't possibly open the door to all this difficulty and dysfunction in my life. And I thought, well, I'll leave that aside. Maybe it comes through with a kind of forced hilarity, trying to make something of it. Later, in my 40s, I wrote a book called My Secret History. That's when I began to write. I thought, you know, the things I've done, the life I've led, is some of it's worth writing about. I was an altar boy. I was a Boy Scout. I was a Boy Scout with Michael Bloomberg, mayor of New York City. We were Boy Scouts together in Medford, Massachusetts. He was in Medford High School. So, you know, we took our different paths. I took the road not taken, you know, the fork in the road. He became a multi-billionaire, and I became I'm on a book tour. But so I was a Boy Scout. I thought, I want to write about this. I liked camping. I went to Africa. So My Secret History was my first attempt to write about myself. In my travel, I kind of suppressed that until I learned how to do it. And you learn how to do things by an apprenticeship that a writer isn't fully formed at the beginning. That you learn how to be a writer. You learn how to write about your life. You learn how to look at the world. And you fall in love and out of love. That's why, you know, students read Anna Karenina and they think, yeah, it's kind of interesting. But Anna Karenina is a book about a woman who leaves her husband and children. It's a tragedy, and commits suicide. And you think, it's not really a book for a student to study. It's someone who's been through some tragic marital discord will understand Anna Karenina. You know, and you'll see just how awful it is and how wonderful Tolstoy captures that. Yeah. So it's kind of, it doesn't do it a service, actually. So you learn how to read. You learn by living, by growing older. You learn how to read, and a writer learns how to write. And I think if you have any sense at all, you get better at it. You improve. You see the world more clearly, and you become more humane, I think, in the process.
More humane,
I hope.
You know, Shakespeare couldn't have written King Lear when he was a child, when he was a young man.
Oh, yeah, that's a point.
The sort of experience. What I find so interesting in your book is, in spite of that security, and you refer to your wife back home, you blackberry her and talk to her and stuff on the phone, and you refer to her as your Penelope, as that form of security back home. But what I so admire is that, in spite of that security that you felt, there's rather sort of fearlessness in this book and in your travels. I mean, I like to get around a bit, but I don't think I would be traveling quite as into these countries quite as openly and sort of, as I say, fearlessly, as you do. I'm quite amazed by that. I associate some of these places being dangerous, and I associate, you know, some people that I'd be sharing a compartment on a train with as being, you know, out to get my money, and yet you're there drinking with them, and you're, you know, smoking ganja with them, and you know, it makes me sort of think a little bit about this. At the end of the Railway Bazaar, you quote Naipaul. And you write, there are people who wish themselves upon societies more fragile than their own, who in the end do no more than celebrate their own security. Mm. Now, a reviewer borrowed that line in a review of the Great Railway Bazaar and talked about how you seem to travel not for self-assurance, but for exposure.
That's actually the mission of the traveler. I could say that my reading life started with books like Robinson Crusoe, and a book I remember when I was very young called Lost on a Mountain in Maine by Don Fendler. Has anyone read that book? Lost on a Mountain in Maine. It's about a young kid, 16 years old, who went to Mount Katahdin and just got lost, and he was lost for a couple of weeks and then found, and everything was all right. I loved books about ordeals. I loved books about risk. I loved books about adventures in Africa. 116 days in an open boat. Person, you know, their boat capsizes in the Pacific. They get into a rubber dinghy and they have to survive. Much more than, you know, Pride and Prejudice or you know, what have you, Jane Eyre. Books about ordeals, risk, adventure. Adventure stories, yeah. I suppose. 2 years Before the Mast is an adventure story. It's not a boy's adventure story, though it's sometimes cast as that. The idea of this guy on the ship climbing the mast. He's 21 years old. He's supposed to go to Harvard. His eyes aren't very good. He's there on a ship. So my reading life was informed by books about risk. And I thought, really, there's no point in traveling. The idea of going, you know, sampling the wines up the Rhine Valley or going to the south of France or being in a spa or in a gourmet trip, that really says nothing to me. You have a good time and you say, you know, wish you were here. But to me, a book that someone like, there's a book called The Fearful Void by Geoffrey Moorhouse. Has anyone read it? Maybe not. Came out in the 70s. Geoffrey Moorhouse is an English journalist who worked for The Guardian, learned Arabic, learned to ride a camel, learned to use a sextant. GPSs weren't available then. And so Arabic, camel, and the sextant, then went to Mauritania, hired two guys, two Tuaregs, and then set up to cross the Sahara from west to east. It hadn't been done, it hadn't been written about anyway. People had done it in the other direction. And he didn't make it, but it's a terrifying, scary story, and the fearful void, because he said he was afraid of the unknown, and so he went out and did the unknown. To me, there's no point if it's not difficult, if it's not risky. There's almost no point in doing it. You know, I mean, the idea of just taking an RV and going, it would be fun. I mean, I'd like to do it with my wife. You could watch TV, I guess, and be okay. But actually, the great moments in my travel are the moments that informed the travel. I was in the Trobriand Islands, and I remember two boys were jabbing me with spears and saying, "You dim dim." Dim dim was a foreigner. "You dim dim. Run for your life. Run for your life. Dim dim." And they were jabbing my kayak. Of course, that, you know, you don't go to a place for that. But I thought, this is, you know, this is an amazing.
This is a great moment.
I was totally isolated. I thought this was like it was like something that had happened in the books that I had read about. Like it was like a weird comic book fantasy of two little angry, fearful boys with rusty spears. "You dim dim, you dim dim." Then I remember in northern Kenya, a guy shooting a shifter. The Somali bandits in northern Kenya are called shifter, the shifter tribe. It's a synonym for bandit. They were shooting. I said to the guy next to me, "Apanataka kufa," I don't want to die in Swahili. He said, "No, they don't want your life, Bwana. They want your shoes. These are hungry people. It hasn't rained here." So, okay. So we're in a truck. I thought, okay, I would rather be here than home. I'd rather be, this is something I've found out something. And I've never gone to a place to get shot at, but that there was an intensity to that experience that was worth writing about, and a teachable moment.
There's a wonderful moment in this book, and I'd like our conversation to sort of attach itself to some of the countries that you visit in Ghost Train. But by association, what I'm thinking about is a moment when you're visiting the poorest part of Mumbai, I believe it is. And perhaps you can describe that part of that city a little bit. But you use the occasion to talk a little bit about how you felt safer in that quadrant of the world, in that lonely little quarter of Mumbai. You felt safer there than you perhaps would have in an American city, in an inner city in America.
Well, it's not so much that I felt safer. The great unwritten book is the book about. This debate was kind of interesting for the things they're not mentioning. They're not mentioning immigration. They're not mentioning poverty in any serious way. They're not mentioning in any penetrating way about the inner life of this country. What is the great travel book about America? Where is it? About, say inner city America. Maybe there are some, but there's no great book, none recent, none that I know. One of the reasons that people travel, maybe it's the reason that I travel to the wider world, is that people in Africa, people in India, in Mumbai, as you say, in Burma, in spite of the fact that their governments maybe not serving them very well, are hospitable. So you can go to a place in Mumbai or Nairobi, or a distant part of Uganda, or anywhere in Africa, almost, and say, "What's your name? Where do you live? How much money do you have? Where are your children? How many children do you have? What sort of thing do you do? Do you get paid for it? How much? How old are you?" You ask any question, and you'll get an answer. The poor are accessible. They're hospitable in most of the world, in much of the world, in folk societies. You can talk to them. This is not the case in this country. I don't know what the reason. One is, I was in San Francisco the other day at the airport, and a voice came over saying, "We are at threat level one. We are threat level one. This is red alert threat level one. This if you see anyone with a suspicious package, that we are threat level one. Please report that person." I thought, where did I hear this? In a 1950s science fiction. We are our heads are being bombarded with fear, threat, report someone, suspicion, difference, other. So we're being turned into a nation of paranoid people. Mm-hmm. This doesn't happen, in much of the world. So if I went, the questions that I ask someone in a slum in Bombay, if I ask them in parts of LA, parts of New York, parts of, I come from Boston, Massachusetts. If it was, parts of Boston, they'd say, "Go home. Who are you asking?" I mean, most people would say, "Who are you? Why are you asking me these questions? I'm not interested in you. I can't answer that. Go away." Not because they're inhospitable, but because we're taught to fear strangers. This is a plural society. This isn't a monolithic society with. A universal standard of politeness. We're a lot of different people jostling for space. You agree? And when you're in an airport, you don't hear this in train stations. In the train stations, you don't have to take your shoes off. You don't go through a metal detector. You show up 15 minutes before the train comes off, and you get on the train, and you can get off the train. There's no one saying, "We are a threat level one. We are a threat level one." That's George Orwell. Furthermore, if you grew up in the 1950s, in 60s, what did you say? George Bush. Did you say? Yeah. Well, yeah, okay, there you are. But think about it. Think about the idea that someone searches your luggage and you thank him. Think about how you are practically strip searched before you get on a plane. Now, I agree. You might say, "Oh, but someone might have a bomb." Okay, they might have a bomb. But what a world. What a world that where we accept this invasion of privacy in the portion of the book that Tom talked about, which is in Bombay. In spite of the fact that they're uncertain, unstable, and sometimes terrorized societies. I mean, Bombay has bombs all the time. And there are bombs in Delhi, there are bombs in Pakistan. Still, the people aren't as paranoid as we are. Don't know why, but they're not. So in the 1950s, when I was growing up, and you, some of you may remember this, when you traveled abroad in the 60s, we'd go to Europe. Some people went to Czechoslovakia, Poland, East Germany, you know, Eastern Bloc. What was the story that you all brought back? They looked in my luggage. They looked in my underwear. We had a book. They looked in our book. They searched our luggage. That was the big violation of our privacy in the 1960s. They actually opened my suitcase and they looked through everything. That's happened to every one of you. Every one of you has been searched, gone through screening, been patted down, and all of that. Amazing. It's an amazing world. It's a total reverse. We used to see that as the reason we're Americans is this doesn't happen. So just to recap, it's very hard to travel in America for this reason. It's not hard, and the reason why people go to Nepal and China and India and so forth is there's a level of freedom and candor that you can actually find there. I mean, it's a paradox, isn't it? Because this is a free country, yet we accept the invasion of our privacy. And the only thing, you know, what makes life living is our secrets, secrecy, our privacy, the fact that we're not violated. So we've lost that. And in the past 8 years, lost it to an incredible degree. So we should be outraged by it and want to change it, of course. But we're living with the whispers of, you know, we're under threat, fear, that we've been taught fear. So unfortunately,
and come to accept it every step of the way,
and accept it, and thanking the people who frisk us.
Right. You're right. On the other hand, you write quite nicely and quite wonderfully. I guess what I wanted to say is that this book, for your fearlessness, there's such a wonderful sort of narrative tension created in this book as to the places that you go and what you choose to expose yourself to. There's a couple of moments, and I think about one in particular, where it sort of catches up with you. If I'm right, it was like 4 o'clock in the morning, and you'd grabbed a rickshaw, I believe, in Mandalay. And you were asking this driver to take you to this hotel, and it crossed your mind that, you know, you're really beholden to the kindness of strangers. And
yeah.
And there are a couple of wonderful moments. I think about that rickshaw driver. I think about the cab driver that you had in Uzbekistan, Mr. Farooq.
Yeah.
That perfect traveling companion in India, Mr. Kampur Chand.
Yeah.
It's the kindness of strangers that sort of pulls you along in spite of these more darker sides that you approach.
Well, so. It's true. There are risks, but I mean, what you're saying is that I'm a lucky man, and I am a lucky man. I'm a fortunate traveler. A traveler who comes back to tell the story is very lucky. The idea that you're naked, if you know anyone can mug you, hit you, rob you. Standing on the border of Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, you have to walk through it. You walk through you wait at a chain link fence, you're beckoned through, you're insulted by the soldiers and frisked and so forth, and I don't know, they go through and you check your visa. You walk across a no man's land. This is if you go by land, Mike, which I highly recommend. So if you go,
we'll
get
book
off
our
a train
trips tomorrow.
But the only way to go from there, from that border, is an old car from the border of Turkmenistan to Bukhara. You know Bukhara from the carpets, and Bukhara and Samarkand and Tashkent. So you depend, like Blanche DuBois, on the kindness of strangers. And so if you, but anyone can do you. Anyone could do you in. So my stories are less about threat, risk, being shot at, than I think the gratitude I feel as just a solitary traveler. You know, I did a story about the police in New York City once, and I said, who gets mugged in New York? And they said, people who are alone, old people, feeble people, people who can't walk very well, but people who are alone. black people in white areas, white people in black areas, Hispanic people in white areas. When you're different, when you're alone, when you're isolated, just the isolated person, that's the person that gets hit. Not a bunch of guys, you know, big, strong guys. It's just the isolated, and usually the old get it because they're easy. You just snatch their bag and take it. So it's in a crowd, in a herd of antelopes, which antelope gets killed by the cheetah? It's the one that straggles at the end, the young one, the one that's limping slightly. In fact, and that helps the herd, usually creates a gene pool, very strong gene pool, because the bad one, the ill ones, the lame ones are pulled down. But those, you know, the cheetah, the lion doesn't go after the big buck. It goes after the lame ones. So I think I've been extremely lucky to get to the age I am, after paddling around the Pacific Islands and walking around Britain and going around China. I've been very lucky.
I was going to say perhaps less lucky, but still, but more agile and quick-witted.
It's not wit. It's luck. Believe me, luck. Okay. As they say, baraka. It's Barack Obama. Barak means blessings. Luck. Barak. Barakat. That's what I have. Luck. Just bless. Just I don't know whether it's the hand of God, whatever it is, but it could have. I could have. Bad things could have happened to me at any time, and I've been very, very, very lucky.
I sense sort of a political subtext to this conversation.
No, we just saw the the debate. So the debate's kind of mm-hmm. it's circling. You're trying to sort it out. Who won is going to happen. Yeah,
no, it's an interesting.
This is a nervous age. It's an agitated age, and that's the other thing. I saw a woman the other day. She was she's riding an elevator, poking the thing in the elevator. She had a bagel, and she was a bagel in one hand. She had a phone, bagel, elevator, and and I was thinking, this is amazing. This woman's managed to do about 4 things at the same time. It's an anchor, and she's probably maybe talking to her stockbroker. It ain't easy.
I was going to say I want to ask one more question, but before I ask that question, we're going to be opening it up for questions from the audience. So start putting your thoughts together, and a microphone will wander around to the raised hands. But I guess I read this book. I'd say almost 50% of this book I read yesterday afternoon or so, and it's not just a travel book. I mean, I have to admit, it's a rather exhausting sort of pull through so many different cultures. I mean, you span, it's an amazing panorama. I was taking some notes, and I drew a picture, sort of this big arc, starting with, Eastern Europe and Romania, taking us to India in the middle, and ending to Japan and Moscow and the best in return. And I thought about the cultures that you wander through, the people that you've met, the breadth of this planet that you had a chance to experience in the course of your travels here. I kept wanting to just ask the real simple question, what's the world coming to? You talk about world overpopulation, you talk about repressive governments. I mean, it reminded me of Robert Kaplan's book that came out in the 90s, The End of the World, The Ends of the World, a wonderful travelogue that's sort of similar to yours in some manner. But it reminded me made me just sort of think about the governments, the people, the interactions, and sort of the plight of humanity in the course of our global history.
Yeah, I don't know what the world's coming to, but I know this, that you're a journalist, but you actually go in search of stories in much the way a travel writer does. So you don't necessarily chase coups, earthquakes, tsunamis, but you write human interest stories, you write profiles and so forth. So you could probably relate to what I'm saying now, which is that when I went to Georgia, for example, I didn't know much about Georgia. I went through Turkey, and I went up to Batumi, and I took the Trans-Caspian Railway to Gori, Tbilisi, and then on to Baku, and then into Turkmenistan. Okay, well, these are kind of strange names, strange places. I wasn't reporting on a big event. I was writing about the way people are living, and what they're eating, how they're what their conveyances. I was very surprised in Western Georgia, by the relative frugality and poverty of people. That if you flew into Tbilisi, you'd think, well, this is an okay place. It's got a synagogue, it's got a mosque, it's got a church, it's got an opera house. But, 50 miles out or in Gori and then nearer the Black Sea, I thought, there's little huts, like little huts in a fairy tale. People carrying wood on their head and, smoke coming out of the chimneys, people shoveling snow. People having rather a tough time, actually. No casino, no opera house there. Just Gori, that's where Stalin was born. And Gori is also the place that was captured by the Russians who invaded South Ossetia. This is all before then. So I think, I don't know what the world's coming to, but I know that the only way to understand the world is to see how people live, what they eat, what they worry about, what their own fears and hopes are. And the travel writer is a selfish, self-indulgent person who, in a way, is reporting on that and on himself or herself. And so I would say that some places in the world are doing very well. I mentioned Vietnam, how Vietnam actually born from the ashes, just reborn after all this misery and horror. And it gives me hope to think that a place can look so terrible and yet 33, 34 years later is... it's not forgotten, but they're looking ahead. And then some places, other places, Burma, for example, hadn't changed a bit. Sri Lanka, at war. There's a terrorist threat in Sri Lanka. The Tamil Tigers have captured the northern part of the island. Because there's a guerrilla war being fought in Sri Lanka, the country had hardly changed. No one's investing there, and life is rather precarious. So the Tigers in Sri Lanka Tamil Tigers were given credit for inventing the suicide bomb. I don't know whether that's true, but they have detonated more suicide bombs than in Iraq. They have. You don't read about Sri Lanka much because it's not in the news. I think that, as I said, that the travel writer that I am is merely trying to describe the world as it is, and the simplicity, the ordinariness of life, not the extraordinariness that you read in the paper. When you read a news story about a place, it's the exceptional, the tsunami, the invasion, the fire, the forest fire, the change of government, big, colorful story. I'm much more interested in the non-colorful story, just the human encounter and how similar our fates are on the planet. And that's what you find out. That's quite an extraordinary thing, is how bound up we are with the whole world. It's why when we have politicians who really don't know the world, they think, oh, we're special. This country is blessed by God. This country is special. We have a special mission. Well, we don't. It's part of this very small, shrinking, somewhat blighted planet. And we really have to get together and understand that it's not us, in the mothership with the blessings of God on us, that our fate is linked to the whole planet. And the travel writer actually, selfish though the travel writer is, should be trying to describe that.
And I guess as I was reading this, I was thinking to myself that I draw a little distinction between your sort of travel writing and just writing. And that's what I admire about this book. So let's turn this over to you, because we want to get off to a book signing soon. I saw this gentleman's hand raised first, so why don't we go to you here.
Thank you. Maybe this is two questions, but I'll put it together. I was interested in your view of... fundamentalism, whether it's in the Fergana Valley or Fort Portal, two different kinds, and do you fear one or the other, and have they made changes in your history?
Well, the question is about fundamentalism. What do I think about? Any kind of absolutism like that, which is God speaking to me, therefore I know the truth, is obviously the wrong way to go. I mean, God is not speaking to us. He may be whispering to us and making suggestions to us, but a fundamentalist who's so certain about things is got to be someone to be questioned, I think. And I mean, this great country is great because we entertain all shades of opinion, and because there isn't one overwhelming rule that determines how people should behave, other than we have to love each other, be polite, but there's freedom of speech. But there is all kinds of that fundamentalism really seriously worry me, because there's usually a victim in it, and the victim is the person who is not a believer, and the person who's outside it. And that outsider is usually seen, you know, in most places in the world, the name for that indigenous group is the people. We are the people. Most names, Inuit means people, Chippewa means people, Bantu are people. We're people. And so who are the other people? The stranger who comes, that's not a person. You're not a person. In Hawaii, they use the word Kanaka Maoli, the original people. And so who might you be? You're a Haole. You're not a Kanaka Maoli. So there is this level of fundamentalism in believing you're human, but everybody else is not quite as human as you are, that you're a stranger. And so you're the other. And this is the big worry about fundamentalism, is that they are people, and this is all fundamentalism, that belief, that they have the message and you don't. And so therefore, you're an unbeliever. And that's, so you're likely to, you have to be converted or victimized, you know. So that's a big worry.
Let's see, this lady right here, please.
I spent decades as a very, very rough traveler, and I haven't read any of your recent books. I read a lot of the early ones. I would read them when I would come home after a long trip. And I never thought of you as a travel writer. I kind of thought of you as a novelist who, because you had traveled so much, was like really able to describe places with more accuracy than somebody who imagined them. And that you had the ability to nail people's dialect in a really funny way. Like I could see the people that you had talking. So I was wondering, do you think of yourself as a travel writer? Do you like being introduced as a travel writer?
I don't really mind, because travel writer is shorter. I think of myself as a traveling writer. Not a travel writer, but a traveling writer. Most travel writers are people who go to Hawaii and describe the experience of a luau, and what a wonderful time they have. And it's having a great time. And it's the travel pages of the paper are really holiday pages. It's people going on holiday, not suffering. It's having a good time. A traveling writer of the sort that I am isn't actually looking for a good time, but is looking for an experience of, as you said, you were traveling rough. The reason you were traveling rough and not staying at the Ritz-Carlton is you were trying to find out how people live. And you're also trying to save money, I dare say, right? So it's a way of rubbing up against the world. You say, I think of myself, you say, how do I think of myself? I think of myself as a novelist, as a fiction writer, who, because if you write novels, you have to stay home all the time. You stay in your room. And just the idea of staying in a room for a year or two is just it's a terrible thing. You know, you're going up every day and you think, oh, I'm still not done with this. So the end of writing a novel, I feel, just, I want to go somewhere. I'd like to go. I was talking to Tom about Greenland. He's been to Greenland and I have not. And I just, the thought of going to Greenland, I thought, boy, there's a place that I'd like to go, the Greenland or Iceland. I don't really seek a really cold place, or a place that I've never seen before. You know, it'd be kind of interesting. Or to go back to a place that I had once seen. So no, I don't. I think of myself as someone who writes novels, who occasionally takes trips, and because I'm a novelist, I've trained myself to look at landscapes, to describe landscapes. Joseph Conrad said, above all, I want to make you see. I want to make you see. See what I'm writing about. See the landscape. See the trees. See the people. See the faces of these people. Just to see. So you read a book of Joseph Conrad, and you see. You see the place in Heart of Darkness. You see Mr. Kurtz. You see the jungle. You see the river. You see Marlowe. You see the little boat. That's So all writers should aspire to that, to make the reader see, hear, smell. That's the mission of writing, I think. And writing, by the way, I mean, we're talking about misery and difficulty, but writing should be a joy. It should be fun. It should be a refuge. It's you are all readers, or you wouldn't be here. But the joy of reading is something that, I mean, to me, is almost indescribable, the pleasure of having a book that you haven't finished that you want to go back to. You all know this pleasure. The joy is often taken out at school because you have to study it, or you read a book by Mark Twain, you want to read another book by Mark Twain, but they say, no, we're going to read David Copperfield or whatever it is. And you think, no, I'd like to read Pudd'nhead Wilson, then Huckleberry Finn, then I want to read a travel book, Innocents Abroad. You want to read a lot of Mark Twain books because you love that book. So it's, I have in my life that mission to give the reader pleasure, for the reader to share that pleasure that I've had or the experience that I've had in writing. So I don't think of myself as a travel writer, but a writer, a traveling writer, but essentially a storyteller, a fabulist, a person who writes fiction.
And I think it's the stories that you tell in Ghost Train that make it so successful. With that, I think it's best if we probably head out to the book signing. You'll have a chance to talk to Mr. Theroux out there, but thank you very much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.